This is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's show,
Action.
We introduce you to Nollywood, Nigeria's booming film industry.
It's a combination of love story and deceit. You know, it's a story about a young girl who fell in love with a very wealthy man.
It's all part of the world's third largest film industry. And spreading AIDS, why women have become the greatest victims.
There's no sexual autonomy. Women have absolutely no sexual autonomy within marriage to say to a man, wear a condom, or I don't want sex, or I want to negotiate safe sex.
Plus, bringing home the beat of Brazil's favelas. First, this news.
Desembaraço, desenrole o enrolado, venha cai nos meus braços, deixa o corpo balançar. Desembaraço, desenrole o enrolado, venha cai nos meus braços, quero ver você dançar. Desembaraço, desenrole o enrolado, venha cai nos meus braços.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The World Health Organization is monitoring the swine flu pandemic closely. There are other diseases it's watching too, like polio. If you're old enough, you might remember being lined up at school and given a drop of polio vaccine. It was part of a polio eradication program that began in earnest in the 1950s, when Jonas Salk invented the vaccine. There was a steady drop in the number of cases around the world. In fact, the number dropped 99% in the last 20 years. But recently, there have been outbreaks in countries that were previously polio-free. Pakistan had never quite managed to get rid of the disease. And now, health workers there have started going door to door to give free polio vaccinations. But they're not always welcome. Will Everett reports from Peshawar.
A group of women wait in line at the Khyber Teachers Hospital, cradling babies in their arms. They're wearing full-length head coverings that hide their faces. When I try to speak to them about the vaccines they've come to get for their children, they refuse to speak, all except one woman in her 20s.
My son is 16 days old. I don't know what vaccinations he's going to get, but I know if they give him the vaccines, he won't get sick.
The children here get shots against hepatitis, measles, and other childhood illnesses. And they also get a few drops on the tongue of a vaccine that protects against polio. These drops have become a hot subject lately in this part of the country.
Most people agree to have their children vaccinated. They understand the problem.
That's Dr. Saeed Nassim, head of pediatrics at the hospital.
But there are some parents who don't want to be told what to do. They believe this is a plot by America and the West to sterilize their children.
The rumor is the result of propaganda campaigns by Taliban clerics and other extremists. Their goal is to stir anti-Western sentiment. They spread their message on mosque loudspeakers and on illegal radio stations. So now Dr. Nassim and the World Health Organization are taking the polio vaccine door to door, in the hopes they can dispel these rumors one person at a time. Six hospital field workers, four men and two women, compare notes on a street corner in Peshawar's well-to-do Maraba district. Dr. Pervez Mohsin gives them each a map indicating the homes of 32 families who've refused to have their children vaccinated. The workers fan out into the quiet streets in pairs. They offer the families literature on the polio vaccine and plead with them to consider their children's health. At this house, hidden behind a tall brick wall, a woman shouts behind the closed gate, telling the workers to leave her alone. She won't listen to their arguments. She says her husband doesn't want the child vaccinated. She says the reasons are none of their business. Later in the day, at another nondescript home hidden behind a tall cinder block wall, the group encounters more resistance, this time by the grandmother of the house. The polio vaccine is administered orally so that it can be given by minimally trained people. It takes 5 or 6 doses, about 4 to 8 weeks apart, to guarantee lifetime immunity from the disease. At this home, the children have received 2 vaccinations in the past, but the grandmother wants no more.
Every month you people talk about polio and polio. This is a campaign so that we will stop producing babies. Besides, he's already been vaccinated.
You might have vaccinated him before, but the dose is effective for only so long, and then you have to get another dose. Your kids are like flowers and they need to be cared for.
We take care of them. God takes care of them.
God takes care of everyone, but this polio spreads like fire.
Whatever you say, we stand by our words that we won't give him the dose.
But the family is divided on the subject, as we learn when the woman's 18-year-old grandson, Sayeh, slips out of the house to talk to us. He'd like to have his 5-year-old brother vaccinated.
I believe that this vaccination is good for every baby. But what can I do? That's from our grandfather, grandmother. From there it comes to us. But we are studying in the universities and colleges, so we doesn't believe in that.
Dr. Mohsin offers to give the child the vaccine right on the spot. But the grandmother hears this and yanks the child back inside. Sayeh agrees to bring the child to the hospital later.
So when I catch my brother outside the house, so I can take him.
Sayeh apologizes for his grandmother's rudeness and invites us inside for tea.
It's our culture, it's our nature that you can have a drink with us.
But your grandmother hates us.
No, she doesn't hate you.
The grandmother hears this and wants to know where the foreigner is from. When Sayeh tells her America, she refuses to let us in.
No, she doesn't want.
Okay, well, we believe.
At this point, the polio workers are worn out from a day in the hot sun, so they stop at a roadside stand to buy cold water. It's been a good day. They won over about 80% of the families that had been refusing the vaccine. As they get ready to return to the hospital, a beggar approaches in a rickety cart that he's converted into a wheelchair. His legs hang limply in front of him. He's a polio victim from Afghanistan. I was never vaccinated, he says. When I was a kid, I realized my legs weren't growing right. They said it was polio. This leg works a little, but this shriveled one is senseless. I can't even move it. He asks the polio workers if there's anything they can give him for his problem, but they tell him it's too late. They buy him a jug of water and he leaves, pushing himself down the same street they've just come from. Dr. Mohsin notices this and hopes that Sayeh's grandmother is watching. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Peshawar, Pakistan.
Kids across the country are in the middle of summer vacation. When they go back to school, most of them know what to expect. A list of new teachers, new textbooks, and a fairly regimented routine. That's not true for kids in rural Mexico. They often walk hours to get to school, and they're not sure what or who they'll find once they get there. Conrad Fox reports from Veracruz State, Mexico.
Noé Tapia is a 15-year-old student at a school in the remote mountain village of Misantla. His grades are slipping, but he says it's not because he skips classes. It's because his teachers do.
They're pretty much all the same. None of them arrive on time. They always say they've got paperwork to do or something. There's some who don't get here until Wednesday at 1 in the afternoon.
The teachers live in Misantla only on weekdays. On weekends, like most teachers in Mexico's distant rural schools, they head back to their homes in urban centers hours away. Most of them, say students and parents here, don't roll in again until late on Monday afternoon and disappear early on Friday. When they are in the classroom, says Noé, not all of them are exemplary educators.
One teacher, he'd beat you if you didn't know your times tables. A couple of kids knocked over a desk once and he beat them with a stick. And then that broke and he took out his belt and beat them with it. And he'd get drunk and pee in the classroom. We didn't like to go. The classroom stunk.
Not surprisingly, parents are incensed over the quality of education here. But, they say, authorities have not heeded their complaints. When the school principal refused to fire the teacher that beat Noé's classmates, they had to band together and take away the teacher's key to the school before he would leave. Noé's father, Leoncio Tapia, blames the union for protecting negligent teachers.
Su sindicato de los maestros los apoya mucho. Ellos se sienten...
The union backs them up in everything. There's no punishment. You can't tell them anything. Teachers go around like kings. They tell us that because they're in the union, they can't do anything.
Tapia isn't the only one to make that complaint. With 1.5 million members, the Mexican Teachers Union has a long history as a powerful player in Mexican politics. And many critics say it uses that power to coddle poor teachers.
El sindicato es, en alguna manera, juez y parte de las decisiones.
It's like a judge and jury. It decides who gets a job and where they are going to work. And when teachers don't turn up, absolutely nothing happens. If a teacher is reported, they go to the union, and the union justifies their absence.
Oralia Bonilla is a researcher working with the Organization of Ibero-American States, a multi-government development organization in Latin America. She says she's seen hundreds of classrooms like Noé's, where absenteeism, abuse of authority, and lackadaisical teaching are hurting students. The worst cases, she says, are in rural schools, where oversight is most lax.
No hay interés por el aprendizaje.
There's a lack of interest in the students to learn, she says. Test results are really low. She points to a 2006 study by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development that ranked the quality of education systems around the world. Mexico placed 50th out of 57 countries. Even the World Bank has blamed the Mexican Teachers Union for what it calls very low quality of education in the country.
I don't agree with these pessimistic views on our education, that other countries come in and tell us how bad our schools are. Veracruz teachers are well trained.
Gaudencio Hernandez is head of the teachers union in Veracruz. He admits some teachers regularly miss classes, but he denies the union covers for them.
Bueno, tan grave no.
Yes, it's a problem, but that bad? No. There's a few teachers like that, but they haven't realized the union is totally against it.
But even some insiders are unhappy with the union. Take Oscar Gomez, who's been a member for 3 years.
It's a mafia, completely politicized. They tell you here you've got to make friends, make sure you fit in.
Gomez works as a school administrator, but is waiting for a teaching post. He claims that all new teachers are assigned to jobs hours or even days from their homes. Getting a better position, he says, has nothing to do with a teacher's ability or students' needs.
They take you on their political campaigns. For example, the buddy of the general secretary will be running for mayor. So they'll take you to the paint signs, put up posters, attend rallies. And as you do more of this, the union will bring you closer and closer to your home, and you spend all your time in the classroom, not thinking about teaching, but about how you can get in with the union.
Union leader Gaudencio Hernandez denies the charge, saying long treks to work are all part of paying your dues as a new teacher.
It's the way we've always done things. The newer teachers always start further from home. When I started, I had to go an hour by train, then an hour and a half in the back of a pickup, then another hour walking, but it made us stronger.
The federal government secretary of education did not respond to a request for an interview for this story. Meanwhile, 15-year-old Noé Tapia is tired of waiting for things to change. He's become so discouraged with his school experience, he's decided to drop out. In Misantla, Mexico, I'm Conrad Fox for the World Vision Report.
Just a note, recently the government and the National Teachers Union agreed that teachers will no longer be able to pass their teaching post on to a child. Now, only those who pass a competitive exam will be offered a teaching position. The goal is to improve the quality of education and eliminate some of the corruption within the education department. Coming up, what do women's rights have to do with the fight against HIV/AIDS? Find out after this short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. HIV/AIDS is the leading cause of death in Africa. Thousands of scientists, healthcare providers, activists, and others work tirelessly to stop the spread of the disease. Over the years, there's been a lot of talk about treatment and a lot of talk about prevention. But one issue you probably haven't heard much about in the fight against AIDS is women's rights. That's unless you've been listening to Stephen Lewis. He was the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS to Africa. Mr. Lewis, welcome to the World Vision Report.
Thank you immensely.
You have given impassioned speeches about how women's rights and gender equality are central to the fight against AIDS. And I know you've worked in Africa for decades. I'm wondering, when did you first come to believe that women's rights are connected to battling this disease?
Well, I understood it initially, I think, when I was working for UNICEF as the deputy for programs in New York. And every time we thought we were making progress against a whole variety of diseases and poverty and disability in southern Africa, we were always turned back by the impact of the virus. And it became more and more evident in the process, even though UNICEF is focused on children, that the women, their mothers primarily, were so deeply involved and deeply infected and affected themselves, and that it was impossible to proceed unless one dealt with the disproportionate vulnerability of the women.
And what is the vulnerability of women? I mean, why is it that the majority of people with AIDS are women?
Simply because of gender inequality. I mean, gender inequality is the greatest scar on the face of the planet. The most important struggle that exists today is the struggle for gender equality. You cannot continue to marginalize 52% of the world's population and expect ever to achieve a modicum of social justice or equity. And the inequality that is so deeply rooted in Africa is heartbreaking. For one thing, and most evident, there's no sexual autonomy. Women have absolutely no sexual autonomy within marriage to say to a man, wear a condom, or I don't want sex, or I want to negotiate safe sex. The prevalence rates, the incidence of HIV within marriages is often higher than it is in the individual women in the surrounding community. It's true everywhere that the absence of sexual independence dooms the woman to contracting the virus.
Okay, now I know this is a pretty controversial subject. Their husbands are obviously having multiple partners and bringing the virus home to their wives, who may or may not be being faithful to them. Is this what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. In most instances, the pandemic is driven by predatory male sexual behavior. I think you wouldn't have the disproportionate numbers of women if it wasn't the men who were straying more vigorously outside marriage. In Africa, where you have 23 million people living with the virus, as you well know, 61% are women and girls. And if you look at the category which is most susceptible and most vulnerable, the 15 to 24-year-olds, between 75 and 80% are young women and girls. So the vulnerability of women and girls is palpable. It's dramatic. And it wouldn't be so dramatic if men weren't having so many external relationships. That doesn't exonerate the women. Women also have multiple sex partners, but it's primarily men with whom the onus lies.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you this, Stephen. What would you say to someone who might look at you and say, okay, here you are, a white Western man, an expert in AIDS prevention, and how dare you comment on our long-standing cultural traditions of having multiple partners? This is the way men have done it forever. They might be married to one woman and have a family, but have several partners on the side. Easy for you to come in and say, change this.
Right. Well, there are some places where cultural relativism doesn't work for me under any circumstances. I don't buy that stuff. There are societies where people throw acid into the faces of women. There are societies where the international sex trafficking of women is acceptable. There are societies where female genital mutilation is acceptable. There are societies where sexual violence against women in conflict and in intimate partner violence is acceptable. It is not acceptable in any norms of international civilized behavior. It's gender inequality. It's damaging to women. And I'm not prepared to embrace the cultural relativism that says because you're a white man, you can't comment on it. Nuts. Of course I can comment on it. If there are grievous violations of human rights occurring, they are universal. Human rights are not something you fool around with when it suits you. And if there are patterns of behavior which violate human rights, then I think I have a right to identify them.
So let's talk about how this can be changed, how women can be empowered to say no to unwanted sex, even in their own marriages, if their husbands have been with other women. What is the plan to turn this tradition around?
Well, you ask a very difficult question, and now I'm not in retreat, but I'm much more cautious in response because it's tremendously difficult. Everybody talks about changing male sexual behavior, and then they acknowledge that that may take a generation or two before it happens. But the women are dying now.
The women are dying in astronomic and hallucinatory numbers in their 20s and 30s, leaving these monumental number of orphan kids behind. So you're quite right. You have to find some way to empower the women. And I have a feeling that if we could get more and more microcredit and some economic wherewithal to the women to give them some real independence, that would make a very big difference. If we can, within the school systems, emphasize the equality between girls and boys and get boys to respect young girls and get girls to recognize their own intellectual, social, economic, sexual autonomy, that would be going some credible way down the road. If there were laws which gave women property rights and inheritance rights and tremendously tough, uncompromising laws against rape and sexual violence, and where you have high levels of political representation of women, as in a country like Rwanda, then I think you begin to change the culture of the society. But it's extremely slow. What one has to understand is that on the ground in Africa, there are tremendous numbers of extraordinarily effective women's groups, but the advocacy they want to engage in is limited because they don't have any resources. They don't know, they can't network with each other. They don't have computers. They don't have cell phones. They don't have access. And that's what we have to give to women on the ground so that they can, you know, they can pull away from the terribly difficult sexual and social situations in which they find themselves.
You mentioned rape as a weapon against women in conflicts, and in your final speech as UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS, you talked about this: the increase in rape on the continent, everything from marital rape to war crimes, and you did mention that this growth isn't limited solely to Africa. But in Africa in particular, it contributes to the spread of AIDS.
Yes.
What can be done for women to prevent this sexual violence that we're seeing in places like the Congo right now?
Oh, there has to be a sort of massive international response. Peggy, you raise a question with which I must admit I'm personally obsessed at the moment, almost to the point of being unstable about it. In Liberia, the focus of raping now after the conflict, the raping continues, of course, the focus is on 10 to 14-year-old girls. Mm. In Kenya, you saw that terrible post-election sexual violence. In Zimbabwe, the organization I work with in the United States, AIDS Free World, in Zimbabwe, we've been taking affidavits of the women who have been raped by the Mugabe Youth Corps in the post-election violence, and the stories are staggering. I don't have the emotional equanimity to relay them. They're too horrific, too painful. It's the use of mutilation and amputation and guns and knives, and where all of that is given the most horrific expression is in the Congo. In the Eastern Congo, where more than 250,000 women have been raped in the last 10 years under the most gruesome of circumstances, and where their lives are utterly shattered. Everybody agrees there's a war on women taking place in the Congo. It's not just a war with guns, it's a war with rape. Rape is a strategy of war where you humiliate whole communities, move them off the resources you want to get at through the terrible savaging of the women. And the only way to handle it is if the world, I think, uses the new international principle which everybody agreed on in 2005 called responsibility to protect, where if a country like the Congo cannot or will not protect the civilians, the women, from sexual violence, the world has a right to intervene. Now, it can do that economically, it can do it politically, it can do it diplomatically, and it can do it militarily. We've already got 17,000 UN peacekeepers in the Congo, and they cannot protect the women despite the fact that it's their mandate to do so. So let's triple the number and do something on behalf of the women. It's just appalling. I'm 71 years old. I've spent time in politics, time in diplomacy, time in multilateralism. I never thought I'd reach the age where I would see such wanton malice visited on women with such indiscriminate brutality as to sear the soul. I'm not some sweet innocent. I understand the way the world works, but by God, this is something that the international community has to respond to. They say they will. The Security Council says it will, and nothing happens.
I'm listening to this, and I'm about to cry. You are very passionate. I mean, how is it that the Western public does not have this on the front of our minds? I mean, how do we miss this, that tens of thousands of women are being brutally raped?
Well, there are. I smile gently, a bitter smile, when I hear you say what you do. Eve Ensler, the remarkable writer and author of the Vagina Monologues, has been using her V-Day NGO in the Congo now for some time. She's been there three times in the last 18 months and has been ferociously writing and mobilizing the women on the ground. It's been so effective that she's even appeared twice before the Security Council. And we have had the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, John Holmes, visit the Congo as a result of the inducements of Eve Ensler and come back and write an op-ed for the Los Angeles Times in which he said that the Congo was the worst place in the world for women. And we've had front page stories in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times. There was a major piece done on 60 Minutes. And yet somehow the public is not yet engaged. In my country of Canada, they are more engaged. I don't know.
Too much. You talked about how it has seared your soul. Maybe it's just too much for Americans to take in. It's too unbelievable.
No, I think Americans could take it in. I think there has to be a real effort to expose what is happening.
All right. Stephen, I know you've called for an international agency for women as part of the UN. What do you think that kind of organization can and should do for women to help stop AIDS?
I think merely by having a very strong voice at country level, which would give some support to the women's groups that are making the point of vulnerability, talking strongly and opening about the sexual vulnerability and the sexual reality within marriage and outside of marriage, providing some resources for the women's activist groups so that their voices can be heard, helping governments to design legislation. See, we've always had UNICEF for children. We've always had the World Health Organization for health. We've always had the World Food Program for food. We have themes and we have groups covered by almost every agency. We've never had a powerful and serious international agency for women. The high-level group that was assembled that recommended the creation of an agency did so because of what they themselves acknowledged was a completely inadequate response from the United Nations family. It's been abysmal, Peggy. It's been just hopeless in response to women. And it looks to me as though the pressures being brought on the UN may result in the emergence of a new international agency for women by the summer of 2009, with an undersecretary general. We're trying to get it funded at a level of $1 billion a year, and it would have operational capacity on the ground, and that would make a world of difference. Mm.
Stephen, you've spoken about what this is like for you, how it sears your soul sometimes, and how angry you are at the injustices against women. And you're with these women in their huts on the ground in the villages often, and you see many of them dying. How do you keep doing this? I mean, how do you go to sleep at night knowing the vastness of this problem?
Well, I guess there are two explanations. Number one, futility leads nowhere. You know, you just have to grit your teeth and keep on fighting, confident that somewhere at some point the pendulum will swing. I think that's a basic truth. Certainly it's a truth I've always adhered to. I will admit that I despair from time to time. I cry far too easily personally. And you have images that haunt the mind. But, you know, you keep at it because these are wonderful human beings who have no right to be seen as expendable by the rest of the world. And you want to continue working with them. But most important is the strength of the people themselves. You are sustained, I'm certainly sustained, by the astonishing courage and determination and selflessness, generosity of spirit, simple human decency. These women, they are amazing. They'll do anything for their children. They bury their own children, and then as grandmothers, they look after their orphan grandchildren, and they start parenting again in their 70s and 80s. I mean, it's a phenomenon what's happening in the high-prevalence countries. It's not without hope, because we are making progress. But it's so incremental, and there's so much more to do. And thank God for the strength of the women. All I can tell you is they all deserve a Nobel Prize. Not these hotshots who get the prizes, but the people who sustain the lives of others.
All right. Stephen Lewis, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Not at all. Thank you.
That was Stephen Lewis, founder of AIDS Free World and former UN envoy for HIV/AIDS to Africa. He spoke to us from New York City. We take you to a movie set in Nigeria. That's next on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. You've heard of Bollywood. Now there's Nollywood. Nigeria's rough-and-ready film industry is the third largest in the world. Films are made in a fraction of the time they're produced in Hollywood, and on a fraction of the budget. The quality may not live up to Hollywood standards, but the films are so popular, the industry is booming. From Lagos, Richard Locke has the story.
Stand by, it's drizzly now. Absolute quiet would be good.
A harried film crew prepare for a shoot on the grounds of a wealthy, gated community.
And action.
There's nothing eating me up, Mommy. I'm fine.
On the director's command, a mother reaches out to her troubled daughter.
I'm fine, okay?
No, you are not.
I don't know.
This is low-budget filmmaking. There's no motorhomes for the actors. There's no special lighting.
I don't even know how I feel now.
Is it about Richard?
No, it's not. Then what
if there was a black director's chair, Ike Onyeka would be sitting in it.
Not me. You.
Onyeka has just 2 weeks to get his movie shot,
maybe,
cut, and onto the streets.
It's a combination of love story and deceit. You know, it's a story about a young girl who fell in love with a very wealthy man.
Welcome to Nollywood, Nigeria's booming film industry. While the name may rhyme with Hollywood, that's where any similarity ends. Here, films are made in a fraction of the time and on budgets that would be unimaginable on the other side of the Atlantic.
$30,000, $40,000 for a feature film. It's outrageous. You don't get that anywhere in the world. I think Nollywood films are the cheapest. There's nowhere in the world you film with $40,000. It's not possible. You know, pay the artist. Every single expense of the movie comes under this budget.
Nollywood might be cheap, the final cut a little rough around the edges, but it's now the world's third largest film industry. More than 2,000 films were made here last year alone. And this is where it all began. This is the bar at Winnie's Hotel in the sprawling, ramshackle Lagos neighborhood of Surulere. It was here in the late 80s that actors, producers and directors used to gather, and the whole Nollywood idea got started. It's still a place to come to schmooze with the movers and shakers in the industry. At the pool table, 26-year-old Emeka Okalibe is rehearsing lines for his latest role. In this scene, Okalibe has been called in to help a friend pay a medical bill.
Come on, what is wrong with you?
I've asked myself that. I can't just understand.
Okalibe has had his shares of ups and downs since he started acting 2 years ago. Like anywhere else, the acting industry in Nigeria is a hard nut to crack. So far, he's only played supporting roles, but the glitz and glamorous stardom hold a strong appeal.
Yeah, it does, but my only disappointment, my only discouragement is that the money is not commensurate with the fame. Maybe you played a very rich man in the movie, you have cars, you have big house, all that. But in real life, you don't have such, and people don't understand. They tend to get disappointed when they see that you are not really as rich as you portrayed in the movie.
Are they costumed? The actors.
Back at the film shoot, director Ike Onyeka waits for a costume change. His lead actress is Genevieve Nanji, Nigeria's answer to Gwyneth Paltrow. She commands up to $7,000 a film, megabucks in a country where half of the population lives on less than a dollar a day. But despite the fine jewellery she's sporting today, Nanji says she's not in it for the money.
For me, the passion was in the performance, which I still enjoy. The fame, the glam, the money, everything came later, and you know, that's supposed to be a plus. You know, that's an added bonus. But for me, the joy is in the performance.
Like Nanji, Nigeria's film industry oozes self-confidence. Actor and director Emmanuel France explains Nigerian, and indeed African, filmmaking used to be a colonial enterprise for a predominantly white audience.
The African was portrayed as, the unintelligent person.
In those days, he will act nothing but the tea boy in the films, or the sweeper, or the slave, or whatever.
But now, Nollywood's biggest audience is on the African continent. Africans are watching more of these homegrown movies than imported Hollywood blockbusters. That, says Emmanuel France, is because Nollywood produces stories for African people, tales of folklore, love, and morals, rather than war and famine.
It doesn't matter what language you shoot the African story in. The African who is in Kenya will relate with the same story you are shooting in Nigeria.
Are you all right, my dear?
Yes, Daddy, I'm fine. I just went grocery
shopping. It's late afternoon, and Onyeka is refilming the final scene for the day from different angles, since he can only afford one camera. Tomorrow is the third and final day of shooting. Time is a luxury Onyeka can't afford. There's only 10 days to go before the movie's DVD release. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Lagos, Nigeria.
I just feel I need some time to myself. I do. I need to get away.
Mommy will always be there.
I'll see you.
Cut out!
Mumbai, or Bombay, is the home of Bollywood. The massive film industry attracts thousands of aspiring actors and actresses from all over India. One of those with dreams of stardom is Ashish. He's a 15-year-old who lives in a slum near Mumbai. He's also HIV positive. Dave Snyder filed this aid worker diary.
Within a minute of arriving at Ashish's house, he thrust a small plastic photo album into my hands. It's filled with images of him, or rather, his head superimposed onto famous Indian actors. Whenever Ashish has the money, he has them photoshopped at a nearby camera store. It is more than just a pastime for him, his aunt says. His third grade teacher once called to complain that Ashish was taking his shirt off in class, Bollywood style. Not long after, the same teacher called to say he was too ill to attend school. He was often sick in class, and his weight was plummeting. Maybe she was genuinely worried, or maybe she had learned he was HIV positive. The end result was the same. He stopped going. That was 7 years ago, and Ashish, now 15, has grown little since then. Though he's been on antiretroviral drugs for years, the virus, along with a lifetime of poor nutrition, has dramatically stunted his growth. He stands less than 4 feet tall and weighs just 44 pounds. He has the eyes of a man in the face of a teenager, on the body of a child. When I first met him, I thought he was 7. His aunt and uncle have cared for Ashish and his older brother since their parents died of AIDS. It hasn't been easy. A local aid agency is providing food and help with education for both Ashish and his brother, who plans to go to university next year. But despite the new book bags and notebooks he's received, it's unlikely Ashish will return to class. He'd have to start where he left off, in the third grade, not likely for a freewheeling teenager. He's all about films now. Staff members of the aid agency say he rarely shows up anymore for group counseling meetings, except when they show popular movies. As I talk with his aunt, Ashish sits nearby. At one point, he retrieves a small camera from a drawer and starts photographing me. He has few friends his own age, his aunt says. Instead, he spends his days near their home in a slum in Mumbai, hanging out with construction workers and shop merchants, talking films with whoever will listen. Poor, uneducated, and HIV-positive, the odds are against him. But Ashish has something I can't help but love. The kind of mischievous independence that might land him in trouble or make him a millionaire. You know his chances, but it's likely you'd leave as I did, clinging to that one tiny hope that he might just make it after all.
Dave Snyder is a writer and photographer based in Baltimore.
I came to New York City from Florida to study jazz at the New School University. My drum set teacher was Billy Hart, who's one of the greatest jazz drummers of our time.
Scott Kettner is founder of the musical group Nation Beat. When he first got to New York, he just wanted to learn how to play jazz drums. He never dreamed his teacher would send him on a musical quest 5,000 miles from home.
And so I went to his house one day and for a lesson, and I said, "Well, Billy, you know, we've been playing samba and bossa nova for a couple years now. I was wondering if there's anything else about Brazilian music. Is there another Brazilian rhythm I should be checking out?" And he's like, "Yeah, there's this other Brazilian rhythm from the northeast of Brazil called maraca too. How does it go? Here, show it to me." You know, and I pointed to the drum set for him to come play it for me. He goes, "Man, I don't know how to play it. I just know it's a bad rhythm, and you got to go learn it and come back and teach it to me."
So he did. Scott Kettner took his drum teacher literally and set off for Brazil. He ended up in a town called Recife. While he was there, he met a well-known musician named Jorge Martins. Martins ran a music school, and he took that school out into the streets of the favelas, or slums, to reach the children there.
So I was accompanying him to these favelas and assisting him while he was giving these classes, and him and I just hit it off immediately. I didn't speak any Portuguese, he couldn't speak any English, but for some reason we just had a really strong, deep connection, I think personally and musically. So I returned to New York. I was only in Recife that first time for a week, and then I decided that I really had to go live down there. So I moved down to Brazil for a year. I spent 6 months in São Paulo and 6 months in Recife, where I lived with Jorge in a favela.
Obviously, you were learning music from him, the style of music you had come to Brazil to learn, but I'm sure you learned a lot else living in a favela.
Jorge's whole thing when he was teaching me maracatu and coco and forró and all these other rhythms from the northeast of Brazil, he really stressed the fact that this music doesn't exist without the culture. So the maracatu comes from the poor communities, comes from the favelas.
Well, so that leads me to ask, what exactly is maracatu?
It's a rhythm, it's a culture, it's a way of life. It originated approximately 400 years ago when the African slaves would have crowning ceremonies where they would crown their own king. And after that crowning ceremony, they would have a celebration where they sang songs and danced and played drums. And it was out of those celebrations that evolved what we call today maracatu.
It's like processions coming down the street. Or can you give us a picture of maracatu?
If you can picture about 150 drummers playing huge bass drums and bells and snare drums, in front of the drummers, if you picture about 200 dancers dressed up as a Portuguese monarchy, That would be what you would see in a maracatu procession.
How often does this happen? How often is there a maracatu procession in the streets?
Yeah, it usually starts to happen around carnival time. So the month of carnival is when you really, when the maracatu groups really start to rev up.
Are maracatu groups the most popular kind of music groups in northeastern Brazil?
Well, the Northeast, when we say the Northeast, there's each state has its own cultural manifestation. In Recife, maracatu and frevo and forró are the three really most popular styles of music.
Scott, I understand you brought an instrument with you into the studio.
Yes.
And maybe playing can help us understand even more clearly how these musical styles differ. Could you play a little maracatu for us and then following that, a couple of these other styles?
Sure. So I've brought in here in the studio with me a pandeiro, which is a Brazilian style tambourine. And I'll play for you now a maracatu rhythm. And then I'll play a couple of other rhythms. Here's the maracatu rhythm. And then a frevo rhythm. Frevo is like an orchestra. It's like a big band. It was inspired by the swing bands from the United States that were going over there. So it's, you know, it's a big orchestra with horns, and they play really fast rhythm. And this is what the frevo rhythm would sound like on the pandeiro. And that was frevo, and then this is how a forró would sound.
Ah, okay, great. Scott, your newest album is entitled Legends of the Preacher. And maybe we could play a clip or two from there to see how this percussion works into the rest of the music, how it sounds once it's all put together. What cut would you recommend we pull to get a good picture of the maracatu?
Nago Nago would be a great example. Nosso rei que veio de mim, nossa rainha já se coroou. Nosso rei que veio de mim, nossa rainha já se coroou. Nosso rei que veio de mim, nossa rainha já se coroou. Nosso rei que veio de mim, nossa rainha já se coroou. Nago Nago Nago, nossa rainha já se coroou.
Well, that is really nice. Did I hear fiddles there?
Yeah, so what you're hearing is our interpretation of maracatu. That was a maracatu rhythm, you know, with the blues progression on top of it.
Your band blends this Brazilian music with also American music, like New Orleans jazz. How would you describe your music and what you've done with the music you've pulled up from Brazil?
I would describe it as Brazilian honky-tonk.
That sounded what we just heard, like Brazilian honky-tonk.
Yeah, pretty much.
And I know your heart is still there in the favelas in a way, and I hear you are giving 10% of your proceeds from your album back to the children in the favelas. Tell us a little about that.
Our record label, Modiba, they're a very socially conscious label. They have this project where they set aside 10% of the sales of our CDs to go back into the community from where this music is coming from. And it's always been a big thing for me to give back to the community that gave me so much.
And what exactly does it go to?
For the past 5 years, I've been conducting a cultural exchange program on my own together with my teacher, Jorge. Our donations go to Jorge's school to help him continue adopting children from the streets into his school for him to give percussion classes, Portuguese classes, math classes, and bring the kids to museums. One of the kids is right now on tour in Europe for the past 3 months. She's been touring Europe.
But what's she like? What's her life like?
Her life is very difficult. Her father's in jail for drug trafficking. I think her mother was a prostitute. Her brothers would beat her up. She, you know, she had a really difficult situation, and I love going back to see her and to see her grow and to see her just, you know, get out of that situation that she was almost doomed for.
Mm. And you stay in close touch with your teacher, Georgie. In fact, I understand he wrote some of the music on this latest album. I'd like to play one of the songs that he wrote. Which one would you suggest?
Yeah, let's play Salve Zay. That's a song that him and our singer Liliana wrote together, and he's featured on the percussion. You'll hear him on all of the percussion instruments on this track.
Salve Zay, Salve Zay.
Scott Kettner, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Remember, you can hear us online or download a podcast of this show and listen to us anytime. The address, worldvisionreport.org. Our production team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Mark Bandy, Doug Boyles, Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepherd, Larry Short, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.